On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Tom Gimbel joins us each week about this time. He's the job expert and the founder of LaSalle Network. And Tom is thinking about firing people today. He's actually been thinking about that for the entire season. How are you, Tom?
I am doing great, John. And I think there's a lot of – we don't have to go down that rabbit hole. I'm sure it's been covered enough. However, I think there are parallels to business and how you need to behave as leaders.
By the way, you did go to that Bears game, didn't you?
I did. I took my family, my brother's family, my parents. I didn't take them. We all went together for the Bears game in Detroit for Thanksgiving.
And that must have been just a lot of fun up until the very end, right? Like you thought, holy cow.
I think we realized that we should be thankful for our family because sports is not always something that's going to deliver positive feelings.
Well, just reflect, though, on the way the Bears handled the firing of Eberflus and what takeaways can business people have?
Well, I think there's a lot. I think number one is that we should always remember that in sports, these coaches have contracts, which means they're getting paid no matter what. And in corporate America, when we fire people, the majority of rank and file employees, they don't have contracts. They don't get paid if they get fired. Now, they may get severance and things like that, but they're not getting paid. So the whole act that we've got to realize is these are adults that know the business that they're in, that realize they're getting fired. And while we should have sympathy for anybody that loses their job, they're still getting paid and they're getting paid handsomely for it. So I think we've got to eliminate that and understand that they're in the, to quote The Godfather, right? This is the profession they've chosen. And I think that's really important. And number two is to say from the team perspective is to show respect for people and say, if people know that they can get fired, to dangle them out like that, like they did with Eberflus, is a little bit of discredit and lack of respect for the individual, I think.
I believe they said that they were trying to ensure that they didn't make an emotional decision and were waiting just the last few hours to make sure it settled in and that it was right. And that's probably a good MO for that sort of thing, right? I mean, that doesn't mean they handled the timing of it correctly, but if one takeaway for all of us is if you have to let somebody go because you're angry at them, let the anger settle before you make that decision. Is that something you would agree with, Tom?
Yeah, I would if it was about anger, but this isn't. This is about results and performance. So let me take it a different route and say you've got a CEO or division leader or a manager and they have certain revenue goals. And quarter after quarter, year after year, they continually fall short of making the revenue and the profits that they're supposed to. That's not anger, that's logic. And to say that you're only having the conversation about the value of that person to the company the day the quarter ends or the year ends on profitability would be a lie. Is that good leadership looks at things all the time and says, when somebody's doing well, and I've been in plenty of C-suites and boardrooms and working with leaders, is that the best teams, they're always saying, what more can we put on this person's plate? They're doing great. Or this person's not performing well. Is it them or is it their team or is it the market? Is it others? You're talking about these things all the time.
Yeah.
So to put this cloud out that, oh, we're only talking about it after the Lions game or after the Vikings game, they were talking about it all the time of, how
right.
long do we hold on to this guy?
Or
I mean,
this
didn't come out of the blue.
Or after we failed to achieve our fourth quarter projection, if it's the sales team at a company or something like that. How do you feel about the process? Can it be done over email? Can it be done over text? Can it be done over a Zoom call? Does it have to be in person? What are your thoughts about that?
No, it should be done in person. And now if you're in a remote location and the people aren't around because headquarters is here and the person works there, then Zoom is a great alternative in today's day and age. But the funny thing is, they were talking about, the Bears organization and the press conference and said, oh, it was Thanksgiving. Well, you know what? Business was done on Thanksgiving. They play games. When it's about making money, it's on Thanksgiving. And so it was really an aspect of, we've had situations like this in my career. And in order to work with companies and to do this, right, you look at people and you say, let's get up early in the morning. The meeting's at 10 o'clock. So we need to have this thing done by 9 and have that person exited the company, or by 8. To think that executives couldn't have gotten to Halas Hall at 6 in the morning to have it done before the coach went out for his press conference is crazy. And they didn't, in a normal company, you have to have lawyers and releases. When you're dealing with contracts that have already been written, there is none of that. It's already the letter of the law of what you're going to pay. So when we relate this to business, the key thing that I say to any team is, number one, be direct and be honest, number one. Number two, forget the fluff. Someone's losing their job, be honest with them. And then to the public, if it's a bigger company or to their staff and their employees, all you have to say is what everybody already knows. The results were not what we expected, and we don't wish anybody ill will, but we've got to do what's best for the majority, not for the individual, and we're making a change. And show confidence in that. And you do those three things, and all of a sudden, people believe in you. That's leadership.
Yeah, right. The rest of the staff, the rest of the fan base, the rest of the customer base. Tom Gimbel, the job expert and founder at LaSalle Network, with some thoughts about firing. All right, Tom. We'll talk again next week. Thank you, sir.
Let's win in San Francisco. Bear down as always.
We were talking a little while ago about AI, and one of you sent us a note saying that last year you got a Christmas card that was AI-generated from family. They just typed in some things that they did this year, and then it wrote a real nice Christmas card letter and put the photos on there, and off it went. How about that? I am fascinated by that and terrified by that. Which brings us to Philip Weiss now, the president of SciFarth at Work, who has AI advice for us today. Philip, how are you?
Great, John, and good to be here again.
What's your thought about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Everyone's exposed to it in one form or another, and the holiday card is a great example. We've had people who actually don't even write toasts anymore for weddings or family events. They just have AI do that work for them. And naturally, the number one place where AI is most heavily utilized is in the workplace. What we are now seeing is the federal government are realizing how prevalent and widespread the use is of AI, whether it's to write something, to manage work and documents, to provide safety and security, wants to give companies a helping hand to make sure they don't get in hot water later. And so just last month, a set of best practices were set forth, laid down, and distributed by the Department of Labor. What's interesting is, with the new administration coming in, you'd think that current guidance, rules, et cetera, would fall by the wayside. But the companies we're talking to are telling us, on the contrary, they want to know how to keep AI use safe. And they also know that a lot of state and local governments, including Illinois for that matter, are increasingly regulating artificial intelligence. So these sets of best practices are probably the best source of advice that we can look to. And they include areas, John, ranging from making sure that you give your employees advance notice when you're turning work over to AI software, and also making sure that the AI you use does not harm your employees, perhaps by discriminating against them or exposing their information. So there's a lot of great stuff in there for companies if they take a look at the federal DOL website.
Hmm. So what do you know? This is actually the corporate world saying thank you to the government for imposing some, if not regulations, at least guidelines on them. You mentioned the word safe. I'm not exactly sure what you mean about that, making sure that the use of AI is safely used. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, that is sort of, that's what the companies are asking too. Like, what do we view as the most important safety risks related to AI? And they come in a couple of forms, John. One is, obviously, if your own employees are supposed to produce work product and they simply use AI, it's not their work. And has it really been properly vetted and reviewed? So a lot of companies are looking at the AI best practices to find out the best way to ensure they have good policies, encouraging their employees to have a hands-on, a human hands-on approach or a humanized review. Another great example of where AI use is not safe relates really to the employees' rights. For example, a lot of companies use AI job candidate scanning equipment. You probably are familiar with this from our prior discussions. Well, the problem with that is if you don't put in the right parameters, for example, you could get a scanner that eliminates anybody who has a, just any kind of gap in their work history, because why would we want to trust a person with a gap? But in doing so, you eliminate people who had medical leave, birth of a child, other unavoidable reasons for leaving the workplace. And that could actually be discrimination, because in some cases you're inappropriately excluding someone who has a right to be considered. So discrimination is still discrimination, John, even if perpetrated by a synthetic tool as opposed to a human manager.
I want to go back to that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. But your previous point too makes it makes me wonder, are you saying that if we're using AI to generate documents or some sort of written material, for instance, we need to ensure that that's in the public domain. It's not proprietary. It's not copyrighted by somebody else, for instance, and that we're using it because the computer sped it out doesn't necessarily give us legal right to use it. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, in part. But the other side of it, John, which I think companies are even more concerned about, is the fact that they wonder, is the work product actually accurate? Does it consider all the factors we want considered? Mm. So if an employee simply puts a prompt or a query into AI and gets an answer that sounds credible, because they sure do sound credible, they really sound legit, but hasn't then done the further individual research to support whatever the document says, they could be putting their employer at risk, whether it's a decision about investments, an acquisition, a legal question. A lot of lawyers have run into this because they just had the AI tool write their legal brief and were surprised at the cases that were included really properly cited or properly supporting of their argument. So irrespective of how it's used, and it's going to be used, John, you want to have policies and practices that tell your people, here's where you double check it, here's where you do your due diligence, here's where you check the AI's work at a minimum.
Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work, SeyFarth, SciFarthAtWork.com. Always interesting, Philip. Thanks for your help today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thanks for dialing into the Wintrust Business Lunch. Mark Hamrick's here, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. Mark, I want to talk about the JOLTS report. Tell us what the JOLTS report is.
Good to be with you, John. Yes, this is an important metric with respect to where the job market has been. It's a little delayed in the sense of the latest snapshot we got is the last business day of October. But JOLTS stands for Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, and it's produced by the U.S. Department of Labor. And among the things that it tells us about is the number of job openings, as the name implies.
So is it good if there's a lot of job openings, or bad? What's the number that we hope for, the direction we hope for?
It depends where you're sitting, John. If you're an employer and you're not able to fill the jobs that you want to fill, that's less than optimal. We know what that was like early in the pandemic. Obviously, strategically or for whatever reason, if you have a sense that you need to ramp up your business to hire more labor capacity, that typically would be during a positive experience with where we are at the cycle. The other part is if you're sort of saying, you know what, we don't really need or want to hire someone right now, that is less than optimal at times. What I would say about the array of data that we get within this report that we got a few hours ago is that, like so many economic statistics, they have been normalizing after the disruptions of the pandemic. And so one of the takeaways from this report is that there is 1.1 job openings for every unemployed individual in this country. And when the job market was deemed to be red hot, there were 2 job openings for every unemployed individual. So I would just say this is normalization that we've been witnessing. And the latest snapshot, we saw the job openings rose at the end of October, but we also saw some other mixed signals. More people thought that they could quit voluntarily in their jobs and did And that is watched closely for a sign of labor market confidence, for example.
So as there is about a job opening for every available employee out there, what's the ramification of that? How does that affect the markets? How does that affect government or even decisions by the Fed?
Sure. Well, first of all, the Fed watches this set of statistics very carefully. And so, for example, it will note that job openings did rebound at the end of October. And remember, October, we got a very lackluster monthly employment report, which included the events of Helene and Milton, as well as labor strikes with Boeing at the top of the list. And so the job market data didn't look very robust in October. And so to see some of this rebounding here, the Fed sees that as the labor market being in generally good shape. Going back to where we knew the job market was so tight, that was producing inflation, or at least coincided with inflation. And the job market's seeing better balance now between the demand and supply of labor. That's not seen as a significant source of potential inflation, or indeed inflation itself. And so the Fed does not want the job market to weaken substantially from here. It would also like to see inflation data continue to come down. Price levels are not expected broadly to come down, but the recent rates of inflation have been a little sticky, but overall coming down, and that's what the Fed wants to see. But they may also continue to be somewhat cautious with their rate cuts.
But if it's trending down, if there are fewer job openings, then it'll cost employers more to get people to work for them. That would be inflationary, right?
Well, I would actually say that it could be just the opposite, John, because if you're seeing that you have adequate supply of labor, then you don't have to do as much to retain or attract workers. So this balance that we're talking about, at least theoretically or rhetorically, is essentially where we want it to be, because we want workers, all of us, to be able to have some measure of employment security and the income that is associated with that. That is a big part of consumer confidence and consumer capability. On the other hand, employers don't want to have to stretch to, you know, pay something on the order of 9% as they were to attract people to change jobs. So we've been seeing the wage growth simmering a little bit, both for those who are retaining their employment or job stayers, as opposed to job changers. And there had been a huge differential between the pay raises that people were seeing in changing jobs compared to those that were staying. Yeah. And that has also come back down to something that's more normal.
Talk to me about rate reductions then. Do you think it's a quarter point? Let's see, this is December. Are we going to get a December quarter point?
That's the expectation right now, John. The financial markets are sort of saying there's about a 75% chance that we get a rate reduction of 0.25%. And let's remember that since the Fed did start easing in September, they delivered both a half point cut and a quarter point cut. And markets have been going back and forth on this question of late, in part because of some soft patches that we saw for the economy that may have been related to the hurricanes and other events that we talked about earlier. But those events seem to have now faded in the backdrop in terms of worry about a soft patch. And the Fed also is still not completely content with where inflation is. So it doesn't want to necessarily go with another half point rate cut based on what we think and know right now, but also believes that rates are continuing to be restrictive. And so if you think about them having their foot on the accelerator rather than having it on the brake, the foot's still on the brake with where its benchmark rate is, and therefore they think that they can continue to take the foot off the brake a bit. But, you know, if we get sort of where we think we'll be by the end of the year, we'll also have an update from the Fed on December 18th, that announcement on their outlook for rates in 2025. And that probably is going to be as important as anything. But we also know we're headed into a year of likely some uncertainty and volatility. And so they're not going to commit to cutting rates substantially, but they may show us what the path could look like.
Well, the markets like uncertainty, but boy, the markets are like certainty. And, yes, you know, whatever the ramifications are of the new administration's policies, the markets are doing pretty good right now, aren't they?
Well, they are, and they have been really for quite some time now. And, you know, you're in an environment where interest rates have been coming down. The job market has remained relatively stable, even within the context of the cooling. So, you know, I never want to, let's say, make a strong prediction about where markets are headed, because I can be proved wrong in a minute. But you take what you've seen so far and say, hey, that's pretty good.
Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst, Bankrate.com. Nice to talk to you, Mark. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
More business news now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's At Properties is being acquired by New York-based Compass Real Estate in a deal valued at $444 million. Compass also gets the Christie's brand, which was previously acquired by At Properties. Full terms of the deal haven't been disclosed. It's expected to be finalized next year. Headquartered in Chicago, At Properties is the eighth largest residential U.S. brokerage by sales volume. It operates out of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and in the Atlanta area. At Properties launched 24 years ago. It's unclear whether the At Properties brand will be maintained. The philanthropic arm of Google will gift $1 million to University of Illinois Chicago for artificial intelligence training for undergraduates. Cranes reports the donation will be used by UIC's Data Plus AI program, which trains students in artificial intelligence across all fields of academic study. The program will also include a focus on ethics and professional mentorship and is set to launch during the 2025-2026 school year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, business of food now. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. It's Giving Tuesday, and we will hear about one of Orion Samuelson's favorite charities after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Years ago, our pal, the Big O, gave me the gift of telling me about a charity called Heifer International. It's a charity based on one cow.
Yes, our founder, Dan West, during the Spanish Civil War, he was a volunteer, and he was handing out powdered milk every day to families, and there were lines and lines of families, you know, waiting for that one cup of powdered milk each day, and he had an idea that said, you know, if we could give these families a heifer, they could have milk every day.
Christy Moore is in charge of marketing for Heifer International, which sends animals and agricultural know-how to 21 countries, including ours. Heifer's holiday catalog is out and ready for you to buy a heifer or a goat.
Those are our two most popular items in the catalog, but we also have honeybees, we have sheep.
And chicks and llamas and alpacas, or you can send the gift of clean water, or buy some seeds, or send a girl to school, or buy biogas stoves for villages. And you don't have to spend a lot. You can, but you can also buy a share of an animal, such as a share of a water buffalo for $25, or a share of a pig for $10. And the beauty of heifer.org is that the animals are re-gifted in a way. The recipients are required to share with their communities. For example, someone who gets chickens shares the eggs. And when an animal has babies, those are given to another family, and so on for generations. And you can donate in honor of whoever's on your Christmas list.
You could buy meaningful gifts and send your loved ones an honor card telling them that that gift was purchased in their name.
Heifer.org is where you can find all the information for meaningful, long-lasting gift giving this holiday season. And many parents use it as a teaching tool about philanthropy. Heifer.org. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
On this Giving Tuesday, WGN Radio and Marquette Bank invite you to support your local community organizations and nonprofits. Get involved, make a difference, and support Chicagoland causes close to your heart.
There's more giving to do on Giving Tuesday. Here is Erin Molik. She is the development manager at Beds Plus. So let's learn about these good folks. Hey, Erin, it's John Williams. You're on WGN. How are you?
I am good, and thank you for having me today.
Beds Plus, so that's capital B-E-D-S. What is Beds Plus? Is that like an acronym for something? What do you all do?
Yes, it is. We started about 35 years ago in 1988 when the community saw a need for shelter for individuals who found themselves homeless. And it started out as a shelter, and it stands for Building Ecumenical Discipleship Through Shelter. And it was a bunch of churches that got together and said, hey, we're empty tonight. Let's make sure we can get roofs over some people's heads.
So do you still provide shelter, or are you doing something else now?
We've evolved incredibly since 1988. And while the shelters, we believe, were impactful and really made a difference, we have now expanded our services to not just put the Band-Aid of shelter and get those people in out of the cold and all of Southwest suburban Cook County, but to really get them housed, keep people from losing their housing and preventing housing loss, and then providing all kinds of resources and services as part of the safety net of services in the community for people struggling with housing insecurity.
One of the things you've evolved into is a food resource program, right?
Yeah, we serve over 1,200 meals a week, and some of those meals are included at our shelter at our Cicero Avenue transitional shelter site, which has over 80 rooms in a motel-based shelter. But we also have transitional shelters at another location of motels. But we provide tons of meal kits that are from food rescue programs that go to clients who are housed who struggle with nutritional items and being able to afford those as well. So a lot of it is kind of wraparound service is what we do. It's not just getting that roof over your head. We're making sure that you're getting all the resources you need to be stable and live a healthy, good life and stay housed.
So what's a typical family or client of yours?
I think that's a tough question because I don't think we have a typical family. I have never interviewed or talked to a family or an individual who has a similar story about how they've struggled with housing loss. It can be anything from someone taking care of their parent and then their employment suffers from it and their job and then they lose their job and then they lost their housing to a family who just is really struggling working two jobs and can't make ends meet. So a lot of times we provide a lot of prevention services for those individuals as well as that face of homelessness, which is that person out on the street who is experiencing homelessness. We provide services and outreach and shelter for those individuals as well.
Now, I must say, there's a church near my house where on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, there's a queue of people getting food. Obviously, the Salvation Army and other organizations like that, Catholic Charities, are constantly providing food and shelter and things for people. I guess what I'm saying is that there does seem to be no end of need. I'm so glad there are organizations like yours that aren't just passing this responsibility or opportunity off to somebody else. They're doing that kind of work too. And you'd think, given all of these organizations out there, that there wouldn't be a need for maybe Beds Plus, but you're in the game and you're as vital as any of them, aren't you?
You know, that's very true. When we started, we had 35 people at shelter. And now we impacted over 5,000 lives in our last fiscal year. And I believe that the housing crisis is reaching epidemic proportions as well. So I think there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about homeless people or people struggling to make ends meet, whether it's food, whether it's housing, and we're here to help them. And a lot of times, as soon as we house one family or one individual, that there's another person going through that same crisis or trauma. And we're here to help them.
Would you say what you're seeing is a result of the housing crisis? Is that exacerbating in any way the need that you're addressing?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it is. And I think for us, we've seen just, you know, rental costs increase by 15% in 2022. And each year they increase. For a family to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment, it's at $1,900. And people are spending more than that 30% of their income on just housing. So they are just one crisis, one car repair, one, you know, missing shift on minimum wage away from being at risk.
So a donation to you, are you looking for food, belongings, or are you just looking for cash so you can meet the various expenses you incur?
For us, the most flexible thing, of course, is always a cash donation. And that's our big campaign for Giving Tuesday. However, we are always looking for meal teams or volunteers to always get involved with us, whether it's at, you know, attending our soup and bread event in February or coming to us and saying, hey, I want to come in. I want to volunteer at the shelter. Yeah. I want to volunteer at the medical respite. We'd love to have people come on board. But for Giving Tuesday, we're really focusing on that cash donation so we can bring those funds and help people stay housed and become housed again. There's a donate button right at the top at our website, and there's also a Giving Tuesday campaign. But if you want to continue throughout the year, because of course, this is the giving season, and we really do rely a lot on this time of year throughout the year for people's generous hearts, but we are always looking for people to get involved year-round.
beds-plus.org, beds-plus.org. All they're asking is for a little of our money, and then Aaron and company will do all the hard work. Aaron Molek, the development manager over there, thank you for being there all year long, and we'll help out on this Giving Tuesday, Aaron.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you to everyone else thinking about us.